You are listening to the cycling podcast, at the Tour de France in association with RAFA, the fastest closing in a world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with RAFA in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam. Stage 1, today we're in Bruxelles.
Back to you this year, obviously.
How did it feel? That's not a good thing.
How did it feel to put number one on this morning?
Yeah, really nice. Well, it's the Tour de France, isn't it? And to wear number one is special. So try to enjoy it. Yeah, just be good to get going now. It's been a long week. This week was always sort of the worst, hanging around waiting, you know?
You know some of these roads very well today. A nervy stage today. Is this one you're quite apprehensive about?
Yeah, so it always is. The first sort of 5 days of the Tour is always a bit chaotic and crazy. So it'll be nice to get this day down and under the belt, especially here in Belgium. You know, it adds a bit something different as well, and the crowd's going to be massive and really enthusiastic, and you know, a few cobble sectors as well, which I'm sure will spice things up. But as always, just try and be in the front and stay out of trouble.
Who do you think is the biggest rival here, the most dangerous rider?
Well, I don't know, there's a lot of good guys. I think obviously Fuglsang is having an unbelievable year. If he can keep that going, that would be incredible. You know, Yatesy, Richie, I think, you know, there's a lot of strong teams as well. Obviously, all of Movistar and Jumbo Visma and UAE. And I think it's just really a lot of good guys. So it's not really looking at one guy, but hopefully I'm up there anyway.
Good luck. Thanks.
Cheers.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are in the centre of Brussels, Richard, in a very attractive square, a cobbled road just to our right here. We're outside the Welcome Hotel bar in Bois à Brûler, which Francois and I have cobbled together a translation, which basically means firewood or wood to go in some kind of chimney or burner.
We should say that we opened tonight with the defending Tour de France champion, Geraint Thomas, who I spoke to at the start this morning in Brussels. Started off, obviously, with a playful reminder of my complete dismissal of his chances last year. I lied to him by saying that I was backing him fully to win this year. Of course, I don't for a second think he's going to win a second Tour de France. To suggest such a thing is utterly fanciful. It's just not going to happen.
Doubling down here. Richard.
And a little spill today, Geraint Thomas, but he not too badly hurt. But we've watched stage one, haven't we? We should explain that we're joined again, once again, for the third year by Francois Thomazeau.
Hello.
Bienvenue.
Merci, and hello to everybody. I wanted to take this opportunity to defend Richard and his fancifulness. I think that any kind of, you know, pronostic, as we say, you make on day one is fanciful anyway, even if it's right.
To be fair, I dismissed his chances after he'd taken the yellow jersey.
That's right.
And so one outdoers.
You can defend me all you like, Francois, but I will not be having that either. So I'm all over the place. Anyway, here we are. And Brussels at the Tour de France. Well, it's great to have you back, Francois. We did a fantastic event last night at the Brussels Beer Project, which is a really cool place. Lots of people packed in there. Terrific atmosphere. Jonathan Vaughters joined us. Giro Scogna Emilio came along and joined us. And Orla Shinui and Seb Piquet as well.
Oh, it was wonderful, wasn't it? A real a prologue to our Tour de France coverage. Limbered up, we made all of our mistakes last night in front of a live audience, so hopefully our coverage here now will be absolutely spot on all the way through to Paris.
Well, let's test that, shall we, Lionel, with the first tale of the attack.
Crikey.
Give us the story. What happened today?
Well, a lot happened actually, Richard, didn't it? Stage one, from Brussels to Brussels. It went out into the countryside. It went over the Mur in Hellersbergen and the Bosberg, these two famous climbs from the Tour of Flanders, of course. Quite early in the stage, which was 194.5 kilometres long, there was a surprise stage winner and a potentially damaging crash for one of the pre-race favourites. The stage was won by a Jumbo Visma rider. Not much of a surprise about that, but it was not Dylan Groenewegen who's in the yellow jersey tonight, but his teammate Mike Tennyson, who's become the first Dutchman to wear the yellow jersey for 30 years. The last was Richard
Erik Breukink, 1989.
Won the prologue in Luxembourg 30
and
years ago, yeah.
Tennyson is the first ever rider from Limburg to wear the yellow jersey, apparently.
Really great stats. I mean, where is Limburg?
There's lots more where that came from, Francois, don't you worry.
Well, as expected, the first break of the tour went more or less as soon as the flag went down, and it had a big name in it, which I was really surprised about, because in the press conference podcast, my prediction was that it would be kind of low-key riders from low-key teams that would fill the first break of the tour, but that, no, there was the Olympic champion, Greg Van Avermaet.
Yeah,
in
we're
there.
From a low-key team.
Controversial, controversial, but okay. Francois says CCC are a low-key team. Van Avermaet, of course, a former yellow jersey wearer, former stage winner in the tour. He was there. The others were Nathanael Behani of Cofidis, Zandro Maurice of Wanty Groupe Gobert, perhaps a little bit more predictable that riders from those two teams were represented, and Mads Voort Schmidt from Katusha. They never gained more than around 3.5 minutes, though, kept on a fairly tight leash by the peloton. Greg Van Avermaet was first to the top of the third category Muir to guarantee himself the polka dot jersey, and that apparently was a goal he set himself as soon as the route came out last October. He then dropped back knowing that he would have the jersey at the end of the day. The other three stayed away. After a section of cobbles at around about 120k, there was a bit of a split in the peloton, and for a brief time Dan Martin and Simon Yates were among the riders in the second half, but that was all a bit of a phony war, really. Everything came back together. The break came back together as well, and with 59 kilometres to go, Stefan Grosseto of Cofidis went away on his own. He gained close to a couple of minutes at one point. I thought maybe would have had an outside chance for the stage, but probably needed to gain more time in the first 10 or 20 kilometres he was away. There was a big crash for Jakob Fuglsang with 20k to go, and he came out of that with a cut above the eye, we think from the sunglasses he was wearing, and another on his knee. He's been x-rayed at the finish, and we believe that is all clear, so nothing broken, but looked pretty bashed up. He did get back into the peloton with help of Astana teammates with around 10 kilometers to go, and then we geared up for the finish, and there was a big crash. A kilometre and a half to go. Dylan Groenewegen was the highest profile casualty of that, and that meant that Mike Tournison, who's riding only his second Tour de France, won the stage. He is a former Paris-Roubaix under-23 winner, a former under-23 cyclocross world champion as well, and he's here as part of Groenewegen's lead-out, but he's had great form since the start of May. He's won the 4 days of Dunkirk. He was in the Jumbo-Visma team that won the Hammer Stavanger race in Norway, and he won the ZLM Tour in the Netherlands a couple of weeks ago. So he is the first yellow jersey of the Tour de France, and if you saw him on the podium, you'll have noticed that the yellow jersey has a design on it of the Atomium, which was the big landmark up near where we were, the press room earlier. The Atomium was built for the World Fair in 1958, which was the same year that the Grand Départ of the Tour de France was in Brussels. The design itself is actually the cellular structure of an iron crystal. I didn't know that, but that's what the design is. And each of the yellow jerseys in this tour is going to have a distinct design sublimated into the material, celebrating either the tour or France, and what have you. So Mike Tournison is, well, Groenewegen's the atomic tadpole. What does that make?
Dylan, but I was going to ask Francois, how did this Grand Départ compare to 1958?
In 1958?
Sorry.
Yeah, well...
Sorry, Francois. I'm joking. I know you weren't covering the Tour de France in 1958.
I was almost there, you know. I mean, in terms
in
of...
In spirit.
Yeah, I mean, only three... You missed it by 3 years. I mean, you know... Because I was born in Lille in 1961, so it's not too far away. I might have done it just, you know, had my parents had known each other.
Absolutely cruel stuff.
The fastest closing in a world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and Watch with Rafa in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our headline sponsor. Rafa have a pop-up here in Brussels, and we are going to go and visit that tomorrow morning. So if any of you are here and you happen to be listening to this before about 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, we're going to go there and have a coffee and hang out for a bit before the team time trial in the afternoon. So a couple of people from Rafa came to our event last night. That was very nice of them. And I know that Jonathan Volta's book launch or book event was held in the RAFA pop-up a bit earlier as well. Thanks very much to RAFA for their continued support. So today's stage, Mike Tournison, well, it was a big surprise and a very unconventional sprint. I mean, he came from a long, long way back. Obviously, Groenewegen was on the ground and out of it. Sagan was there, as he always is. It was a very, very narrow win in the end. The big disappointment was probably De Koning Quickstep, who had a great lead-out train. Richese and Morkov were there, kind of turning their heads, looking for Elia Viviani, and he was way too far back. So I'm not sure exactly what happened to him, but had he been well positioned, he had a perfect lead out.
It's going to be a disappointing tour, I'm afraid, for sprinters generally speaking, because already from the start we knew that some of the main ones, Kittel, Cavendish, Gaviria, are not here. Arnaud Démare, I mean, a few of the big names who won stages in the past years are not there, and the ones who are there, we were all expecting Viviani, Groenewegen to shine. Well, Groenewegen crashed. Hopefully, it's not so bad, but Viviani didn't show the sort of strength you would expect from him, and Caleb Ewan, with a good lead out as well, was only third behind Sagan. We've been saying all year round that Sagan is not, this year is not the Sagan we used to know, but he's still there, not far from him. And he got beaten by Mike Tunison. Okay, is the guy's in shape. The guy also is in the dynamics of cyclocross riders, because it's all the rage these days, either Van der Poel, Wout van Aert. I mean, all these cyclocross specialists, there used to be a time when mountain bikers were doing well, and the new trend seems to be, cyclocross guys. But once again, Tunison explained why and how he won, and maybe it's an old thing of sport, being relaxed, being calm and being. Tunison said he was actually with Groenewegen when Groenewegen crashed, but he didn't see it. He said all of a sudden I didn't see any yellow around me. I was on my own. I heard on the I heard that Dylan had crashed, and all of a sudden I told myself, what am I going to do? If I don't do anything, the first guy in the team will be 25th, so I'm going to go for it. And as he said, in the last kilometer, I was ever so relaxed. I had nothing to lose. I didn't have to do my job, which is to be the lead out man. So I said, well, let's go for it, and I had nothing to lose. So I guess he was probably less tense than the other guys, and in the end, it paid off. And that's because maybe there was the adrenaline of seeing, knowing that you're not going to do your job. They're also kind of the weight off your shoulders, and there you go. And in the end, my impression is that we even Colbrelli, all these guys, I mean, there are not many bunch sprints in the Tour this year, but even the few ones that we're going to see are always going to be very undecided, because nobody seems to be really sprinting well.
It looked to me like it was almost an advantage to him not to be a sprinter, because the sprinters, Viviani and Caleb Ewan in particular, were trying to sort of wriggle through the middle, and they kept getting blocked. They were trying to find a way up through the middle without ever coming out into the wind, because that's anathema to them, to come out into the wind, whereas Tennyson just rode in the wind all the way around and had a clear run at it, and Ewan and Viviani were never able to actually sprint properly.
Yeah, he almost sprinted with the freedom of a lead-out man.
Of not being a sprinter, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is here as lead-out man for Groenewegen. Richard, as you pointed out, he was with the development team, the Lotto Eno Jumbo development team, and had a couple of years at Sunweb, and then he's joined Jumbo Visma at the start of this year. And well, last year we saw Timo Roosen being Groenewegen's kind of lead out man, but for a combination of circumstances, Tournison has found himself in the driving seat for the lead out, partly because when they first raced together, Groenewegen and Tournison at the start of the year in Valencia, they won a stage there. They won a couple of stages at Paris-Nice. Tournison played a big part in at least one of those. And then Timo Roosen crashed at Kern-Brussels-Kern, came back from that, crashed again at the Tour of California. Although he raced at the Tour of Switzerland, he wasn't selected for the Tour. And so Tournison's come into this race as the lead-out man for Groenewegen. And lead-out men can't be afraid of being in the wind, as you pointed out there. And so once he had himself in front and he saw the line, he had nothing for it but to put his head down and go for it.
It's what's interesting is about lead-out men. We always have this question. I know Mark Renshaw who just announced that he was retiring. he always had this question, why didn't you try to not to be the lead out and meant to be a sprinter? By yourself. So Rancho tried a little bit. Tunison answered the question today. He said, no, I'm when I won the Dunkirk 4 days, for instance, Dylan told me go for it. You know, it was kind of a reward for being a good lead out man. And today he even said, I tell you the truth, I don't like bunch sprints. You know, they're far too dangerous. So when he was asked, you know, why. You showed today you could beat the best, some of the best sprinters in the world, and you did. Why don't you become a sprinter yourself? And he said, "No, I don't like to do that. That's not, you know, nine times out of ten, Dylan would beat me in a bunch sprint. This was not a real bunch sprint, and I hate bunch sprints. They're far too dangerous. So it says a lot about these guys, lead out men. You know, they have a role to play. They have a place, a position to fulfill. And it's you know, maybe they're not the guys, you know, raising their arms across the line, but it's really a speciality. It's not like, you know, second best.
Shall we hear from one of Tønnesen's teammates, Jumbo Visma, the Norwegian champion Amund Grøndahl Jansen? I spoke to him at the finish, and this is what he said about not only missing the crash, but hearing how his teammate had won the stage.
A great way to start the tour, but maybe not with the rider you expected?
It's completely different than we expected, but it's still a great feeling.
Can you talk me through what happened in the finish from your perspective?
It was really hectic, but in the end we were there in a position where we still believed we would get Dylan in the position to win. But we needed to make some space and move over to the right. Wout and Mike just made the move, and me and Dylan following them. But something happened in the middle of the peloton in front of us. There was two guys riding into each other and braking hard. I had to really, really brake as a consequence. And I just managed to stay upright. And I think maybe Dylan or someone hit me from behind and went down. That was, of course, a really strange moment. I was still looking behind me to see if he got through or not. But in the end, we had to change the plan. I couldn't do anything more as I was really in the back of the group. I was even lost almost. So Wout pulled the sprint for Mike, and it's incredible that he wins. It's just, I can still not believe it.
When did you hear?
I saw him. I was still sprinting myself, and I was thinking of or at least making an okay result. But then I saw Mike up front sprinting. And suddenly, he made a move out in the wind to challenge the riders sprinting for the win, and I almost couldn't believe my eyes. It was, I had to stop pedaling and just start looking.
And not just the stage win, but the yellow jersey as well.
Yeah, it's for sure for Mike, it will always be his career before and after he won this stage.
Well, that was one of Mike Tønnesen's teammates, Amund Jansen from Norway, and I spoke to his sports director as well, Grisha Nierman, at the finish, and here's what he had to say. When you saw Dylan on the ground there, you must have thought chances for today were finished, did you?
Yes, of course we thought that we were really in the car like, oh, fuck, shit. We're not going to win. We're not going to get the jersey. There was a big focus for the opening stage, and I just said to the riders that were still left, Mike, Wout, said, do your own sprint. We see what happens. And I never, ever imagined that we would still walk off with the win.
Was there a chance for them to improvise, to maybe have a new kind of lead out with Wout involved in that, or were they just riding for themselves at that point?
Actually, I think it was that chaotic that they were more or less looking for themselves at that moment. And also Wout, he already did a lot of work in the wind to keep Amund, Dylan and Mike in position, so he was already a little bit tired. And Mike just took his chance and he did the very, very brave sprint.
He's been riding very well. He's won a lot of races coming into the tour. So from that point of view, are you not necessarily that surprised? You felt he was capable of this?
Yeah, I mean, we see him as one of the best lead-out men in the world, absolutely. That works also really, really well between him and Dylan. But coming into Tour, also Wout, he had a bunch sprint stage win in the Tour, but unless that, Dylan is our undisputed leader for the sprints, and he will also stay our undisputed leader for the sprints. And we didn't really expect the outcome of today.
You've got three sprinters now.
We've got three sprinters, but I can assure you that we also have very, very good team orders, and that the boys, they know themselves what they want and what they are going to do, and we are not going to have problems because we have three good sprinters.
And has he got a good chance of holding on to the jersey tomorrow in the team time trial?
Yeah, I guess you have to win to hold on to the jersey in the team time trial. But of course, that's our next big goal for this Tour de France, is doing a good team time trial. With Tony Martin, we have like a few really, really big engines. We have a very strong team for that. But yeah, we'll let sleep over, and then we try again to do our best tomorrow.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of our Tour de France coverage is sponsored by The Economist, which is a smart guide to the forces impacting your world. And if you live in the UK, you can get a free print copy of The Economist by texting the word cycling to 78070. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, the arts and the environment. And Richard, it's for somebody just like you who never stops asking questions, wants to know all about the world around him. What have you been reading in The Economist lately?
A relevant article, because it's about France, and it takes me back to Francois's famous water challenge a couple of years ago. It's an article headlined Green on Blue, Heat, Water and Plastic in France. It's been very hot, of course, in Europe. Temperature hit 45.9 degrees last week in Orange in Provence. And water was in short supply on a train that the article writes about, a scene on there of passengers wilting in the heat. Now, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has vowed to make our planet great again and really drive through some green policies. But France is not as green as it would like to think, says the article. Part of the problem is the sheer volume of water consumed. No French supermarket trolley reaches the till without a six-pack of litre bottles wrapped in yet more plastic film. After the Italians and the Germans, the French are Europe's biggest consumers of bottled water. Well, we know that, of course, because Francois has drunk so much bottled water that he's able to identify them by taste. Is that a surprise to you, Francois? I mean, is that...
A little bit, because I had the impression that the Spaniards, for instance, drank far more, well, mineral water than the French. To be honest, I'm a little bit surprised, because tap water in France generally, prides itself as being among the best in the world. So,
but a lot of the great French.
So I should. Yeah. I mean, I know there are quite a few French friends listening to the podcast. Guys, drink tap water. You know, it's good.
There's no alternative in the press room, though, is there? I mean, some of the bathrooms in the vicinity of the press room, I wouldn't want to risk the tap water there. We go through quite a lot of bottles of Vittel during the tour, don't we? Because that's the official water of the tour. And, well, I think I had four little bottles of Vittel today, all in a plastic bottle. Not really sure what we can do about that. That's one of a number of thought-provoking articles in The Economist, and if you would like to get a free copy delivered to you, just text the word cycling to 78070. That's cycling to 78070.
Well, almost inevitably, crashes were the other story of the day. I remember last year, of course, it was a very quiet stage, very, you know, kind of subdued almost, and then in the final part, we had Chris Froome running off the road and into a field. Egan Bernal as well lost quite a lot of time. And Nairo Quintana, too, lost some time last year in Stage 1. The big loser today, not in time, but in injuries, was Jakob Fuglsang, who came in as such a kind of strong contender for the podium, at least, the leader of the Astana team. Had a nasty crash, and as you said, Lionel, a lot of blood on his face, above his eye. It's a problem that with the sunglasses, isn't it? Geraint Thomas had the same thing at Tour of Switzerland when he crashed. So he was in a bit of pain and went to the medical truck afterwards, had an x-ray. He's okay, but his knee and his face quite sore. And that's a problem with the team time trial, I would think, because that's such a difficult event. He's going to have an uncomfortable night, and it'll be interesting how the team gets on. Such a strong team, of course, Astana. And I spoke to his fellow Dane and Astana teammate Magnus Cort at the finish. He was on Fuglsang's wheel, as we'll hear, when the crash happened. Did you see what happened when Jakob came down? Did you see what happened in the crash?
Yes, I was sitting on his wheel. I think a couple of guys touched wheel and crashed to the left where Jakob was sitting, just in front of him, and he had nowhere to go, so he rode straight in and over the handlebars.
Did you get a chance to speak to him? I mean, how badly hurt was he after that?
No, we didn't have too much chance to speak. Obviously, I just told him, get up on your bike and let's go to the finish line. And yeah, I don't really care in the race how much he hurt. He has to get back in the bunch, and that's the only thing that really counts. And then we can have a look now.
Not a great start, though. Not the kind of start you would have wanted today.
No, for sure. It's not what we wish for.
So that was Magnus Cort, and we'll wait and see how Fuglsang is tomorrow. But he wasn't the only faller, was he? I mean, the Groenewegen crash was pretty nasty. Groenewegen came down first. Matej Morhec, the Barry Merida rider, went over the top of him and really slammed his head to the ground and had his head in his hands afterwards. And it didn't look good at all. I didn't see him at the finish, but that was a really heavy fall for him. And I think his head took the brunt of it.
Yeah, the only news we get, you know, well, I was going to say so early after the stage, are usually the, you know, official medical statements, and they look reassuring for the guys crashed, you know, with Groenewegen, but as we know, you know, you sometimes they go for medical checks at the hospital, sometimes they have a bad night. Tomorrow is a team time trial. It's a very, very tough effort. So I mean, these crashes could have you know, could really be a toll to pay. I was at the buses. I was trying to get to where, and well, I actually came across Enrico Pochka, who was the Bora Ansgar team director. He was, it usually is very, you know, kind of friends, so he talks to me easily. This time he didn't, because I mean, obviously Peter Sagan lost to Mike Tunisian, which was very unexpected, and Emmanuel Buschmann was also involved in a crash. He's a guy who's you know, crucial to Bora Ansgar GC ambitions. So as we see from the start, you know, some of these teams, well, and Astana are the, you know, probably the most hampered for the time. It's very difficult to know. I talked to Alexander Vinokourov, I talked to Dmitry Fofanov about it, and themselves, they don't really know, you know, how bad Jakob Fuglsang crash was. The most spectacular was the arch, you know, the eye, because it's very, you know, it bleeds a lot. But you never know. There's some of the bruises or the injuries, they can the next day they can affect you, and if you lose time in the TTT for a rider like Fuglsang, I mean, it's, you know, you can lose a minute, you can lose the crucial time that will be crucial in the mountains and later in the race.
It's always totally underestimated, isn't it, the impact of crashes in the first week of the tour.
You know, but we've said before how seldom it is that the winner has had a crash.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And staying upright is pretty much, you know, it's one of the most important things, because each of these little knocks will take its toll in some kind of way. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, just because it's only, you know, a short stage, isn't it, a team time trial, but it's a full-on five-star effort, a team time trial, because and also, you know, time can be given away in clumps, can't it, in a short stage, and before you know it, you're on the back foot. And somebody like Fuglsang, if he was gonna get on the podium, before the tour had the impression that he would have to have kind of the perfect first week and kind of get through with absolutely no incident, not really having to, you know, even just the 10K chase. I know he wasn't on the front doing the work. He's sitting in his teammate's wheels, but they've got to close that gap. It took them quite some time to do that.
He showed some form. You could see by the way he chased to you know, to get back into the bunch, that the legs are
absolutely
are great.
Yeah. But you can be going as well as you like. If you have to take a spin in the washing machine, you're going to come out, you know, bruised.
Clean.
Clean and bruised.
There was also an intriguing thing. Just a quick one. I know we don't like to do previews on the cycling podcast, but there was from the start of the tour, from the moment when the course was announced, there were all this talk about the team time trial being so early in the race, and that normally stage one would give an indication on who would hold the yellow jersey for a while, you know, after this. Mm. And well, now what to say?
Well, as Nierman said earlier, you know, I asked if he thought Tunisian would keep the yellow jersey. He said, well, to keep the yellow jersey, we have to win the team time trial. You know, whoever crosses the line in the quickest team tomorrow will almost certainly be in the yellow jersey. So, although we're expecting a very close race, we will look ahead to that. I was interested to see that Team Ineos are off first in the team time trial tomorrow, which is very interesting indeed. And I don't think they'll be that happy about that. I don't think you want to go off first particularly. Although maybe it doesn't matter in a team time trial so much. I don't know. But another little story that's brewing is Mark Cavendish. Mm. He's not here, of course. But there's
a guy who crashed on stage one.
Well, he one did. Day. He did on two occasions, actually, in Harrogate in 2014 and in Corsica in 2013. That's right. But yeah, Mark Cavendish, his non-selection for Dimension Data, it kind of rumbles on. And there seems to be a sort of split in that team in the management between Rolf Aldag, the performance director, and Doug Ryder, the team principal. Doug Ryder today said that it was a team decision not to select Cavendish. Rolf Aldag then came out and quite pointedly said that it was a team owner's decision, meaning Doug Ryder. There were some rumours that Rolf Aldag might even leave the race, not be part of it, because there seems to be, a disagreement there between Ryder and Aldag about who's responsible for Cavendish not being here. Aldag, we know, supported his selection and felt that he was going well.
Yeah, I tried to call Rolf Aldag actually on his phone. After
he's at the station,
he didn't. Yeah, he didn't reply.
No, I'm joking.
He didn't reply. So it's kind of a plea to Rolf. If you got my call, please call back and tell us, you know, what's going on.
This is an issue of management rather than the highlighting any flaw in the decision. I mean, I can. It's a real 50-50 call, this, whether or not to pick Cavendish or not. And you can look at the results today and go, well, if Cavendish had avoided the crash and got round, I mean, these are all hypotheticals. And you look at Giacomo Nizzolo finishing fourth and think, well, surely Cavendish would be there and would be quicker than. But then, you know, Sagan's in there in second. He couldn't beat Tunisian. It doesn't necessarily follow that if Cavendish had got round, he would suddenly be in yellow tonight. It's far, far from it. Certainly based on results and what we've seen from Cavendish, not just this year, but the last 18 months. The issue for me really is that at the team press conference before the race, neither Aldag nor Ryder were on the stage facing the press. It was left to four riders to kind of field questions that really aren't for them. They didn't pick the team. One of them or more of them might be sitting there thinking, well, am I in because the space was cleared up, left vacant by Cavendish? Just going back to the sort of the press release, even when they announced the team, not to mention Mark Cavendish, who's won 30 stages of the tour, kind of odd, really. At least acknowledge it and say, front up. If you come out and set your case out first, you control the kind of reaction a lot more by saying, right, it was a very difficult decision. We've looked at all of the evidence. I mean, we kind of mock Dave Brailsford for that kind of language, don't we? The sort of management speak, but there are certain occasions that call for it, and I think Dimension Data have got that really wrong. And really, Aldag and Ryder, whatever the truth of the selection, should by now have got themselves on the same page to present a sort of united front, because it creates a story where it's great for us, but one where that must take away from the other riders who are in the race thinking.
In terms of PR, it's dreadful communication. I mean, you take a decision like this, you have to stand for it. But when you take a decision like this, you have to have a communication plan to back it up. I mean, it's obvious. And as you say, either you mention it in the first press release, or you stand up to the press to justify it. But you just don't kind of vanish and disappear and say nothing. I mean, as you say, they created a story out of nothing, because when the news came out, of course there was kind of a shock, but everybody was saying it is understandable, and it would have been so easy to say we're so sorry. Well, there was actually, to be honest, there was a second press statement when they said it was a tough decision and blah blah blah.
But that was in reaction to people saying, you know, you've got to acknowledge Mark Cavendish, whether you love him or don't love him. He's won 30 stages in the Tour. He's one of the most significant figures in the race for the last decade. He's won more or less consistently, you know, all right, not the last couple of years. It deserves a mention in dispatches. If there's a rift between Aldag and Ryder in terms of picking the team, well, why was on what basis was Aldag given the leeway to kind of select his team and then present it to Ryder to kind of rubber stamp or say yes or no? There's kind of a friction there as well, in that the owner obviously has the right to say no, this is the team I want to take, but it's meddling from upstairs when Rolf Aldag is really quite experienced at knowing his riders. If Rolf Aldag felt that Cavendish could come here and be competitive, personally, I would probably have gone with that, really, just knowing what I know about Aldag's history as a sports director.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2019 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and their support of you, because they offer 25% off for all your Science and Sport sports nutrition products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. SISCP25. Not going to get Lionel and Francois to sing it a la Rose and Orla on the Cycling Podcast Femina. But if you enter that code at scienceandsport.com, on all the full price items, you will get 25% discount, which is very generous indeed. And we're very grateful to Science and Sport for their continued support as well. Now, a bit of housekeeping, but a few things to get through here. The mugs, Stacey Snyder's mugs. She produced 100 odd mugs for the Giro d'Italia, and they all sold out very quickly. Well, they went on sale today for the Tour de France, the Tour de France themed mugs. They're raising money for two good causes. The David Carey Scholarship Fund, a young cyclist in Virginia who sadly lost his life to leukemia. I've been reading about him today. It's very moving to read about his story. There's a page set up for him on Facebook. You'll find it. He lived a short but very eventful life and loved cycling. And a scholarship fund has been set up in his name to support disadvantaged young kids in the Virginia area to take part in the Star City Cycling program of events. Also, the West Lothian Cycle Park will be the other good cause to benefit from the sale of the mugs. Now, the first batch went on sale today and they sold out in 8 minutes. So Stacey is going to make another batch and we'll put them on sale as soon as we can, and they'll continue to raise money for those two good causes. But the interest in the mugs is phenomenal and wonderful.
Well, they're
wonderful.
Selling far, far faster than Stacey can make them. I mean, they're handmade mugs.
We need another Stacey. We need another Stacey. We need to clone her somehow.
They wouldn't have the same, the same charm, would they?
No.
They weren't made
and
by
the way Stacey documents the process behind making her mugs so lovingly, and it's really been great to follow that as well. On Instagram and Twitter, you'll find her, Stacey Snyder Ceramics. So thank you, Stacey, and thank you everyone who's bought one of the mugs, and we raised over $2,000 for good causes at the Giro and on course to do so again at the Tour de France. The David Carey Scholarship Fund and the West Lothian Cycle Park will benefit. We're running a competition at the Tour de France to win. We've got an amazing folding bike that we've been loaned for the Tour de France. The bike is an Austin Cycles AC Atto, A-T-T-O, that's spelled. It's an incredible carbon folding bike. It's worth £2,750. We've got a lovely matte black version. It's 11 gears, designed, developed and built in Britain. And it folds up and, you know, it's very, very easy. We haven't actually ridden it yet. I'm going to ride it tomorrow because I've got an interview in the morning. I'm going to ride into Brussels and do that interview before heading to the Rafa pop-up. We'll be telling you a bit more about this bike as the tour goes on and posting some pictures of it. But one of you is going to win the bike. Now, you can win the bike by signing up to our newsletter. If you've already signed up to the newsletter, you can enter the competition too. But if you sign up to the newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com, you can click from there through to the competition page to win the bike. To win the bike, you'll have to tell us why you should win the bike. And we'll read out some of the most funny, interesting, moving submissions over the course of the tour. So thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up to our newsletter to stand a chance of winning this incredible folding bike. And finally, we are being supported once again by Hans Grohe, our Kilometer Zero series, which begins on Monday and runs Monday to Friday, so five episodes a week throughout the tour. Supported by Hans Grohe Showers and Taps. And Hans Grohe have been running a competition this week, and the winner, Lionel, is?
Oh, Adam Beckett, at Adam Beckett on Instagram, and Steph Helliwell, at Helliwell Steph on Twitter. So I think that the prize is a copy of Peter Sagan's book and a Peter Sagan signature Hans Grohe showerhead.
Which I have, actually. I got one of those.
Have you?
Really nice, yeah.
Oh, now you say.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so,
interesting.
Kilometer Zero, supported by Hans Grohe, begins on Monday with first episode will be about Eddy Merckx, and we're in Brussels, obviously. Eddy Merckx is featuring pretty prominently here, and we'll have various voices talking about Eddy Merckx, including television's Daniel Freeb, the author of the definitive Eddy Merckx biography. Well, it is a very good read, The Cannibal. If you haven't read it, do recommend it. Now, Lionel, I believe we have a new feature. Would you like to tell us about it?
We do, yeah. Well, here we go.
And more ears.
Yeah, Francois doesn't know anything about this, so he's going to have the say on whether we play it or not.
No, we're going to play.
Now's your pitch. Now's your pitch.
So this morning, well, my idea was that every day I'm going to go and talk to a rider from a different team. There are 22 teams in the race. There are 21 stages. So on one day, I'm not going to be cruel and do a sort of musical chairs thing where one team misses out. I'm going to speak to somebody from every team. A kind of just a chat, really. It's called Outside the Team Bus, and this is episode one.
Outside the Team Bus with
Alex Dowsett, Katusha Alpecin. After 4 years, how does it feel to be back at the Tour de France?
Just as mad. I feel like I'm taking it all in and enjoying it a lot more than last time. Probably comes with a bit of age. This is one of the biggest sporting events in the world, and it's a hell of a thing to be a part of.
Anything from your first experience that you're kind of trying to learn from this time round?
Don't do an hour record a few months prior to. Be a bit lighter. Just ready. You've got to be ready. The Tours takes no prisoners, which I found out last time. And I am ready.
How are you feeling? How are the legs? Are the legs ready?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, I had a really good Nationals campaign. I think the road race, Swifty was a deserving winner. I think I could have run him a lot closer. I've made a couple of mistakes myself. The sort of most important thing is the legs were there, yeah, which I was happy about. I'm in a good place.
And what's the atmosphere in the team like, and what are the kind of medium and long-term goals in the race?
Anyway, we're on the scope for stages. Zach, we don't know. We'll play it day by day as to whether he runs GC or goes for stages as well. I think we've possibly got one of the most fun teams here. We're going to have a hell of a 3 weeks, both in the race and around the dinner table at night. We're all a great bunch of mates, so it's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
Who are you rooming with?
Mads Wurtschmidt.
And what's he like as a roommate?
He snores a lot, but I've got my... I bought like these Bose earplugs just for Mads, and Mads brings earplugs for whoever he's rooming with as well. So, pleasure to room with, and he's going well, so it'd be good to see him do well, and I'm sure he'll feel the same about me.
What's Ilnur Zakarin like? I mean, we don't know an awful lot about him. He seems to sort of have a bit of a mask when he's racing. What's he like on the bus and in the hotel and around the team?
He's real sarcastic, actually. He's real funny. He's just very dry. He's a good guy. We did a three-hour ride when we got here. I was next to him for a majority. We chatted about. And he does a lot of stuff, actually, for his hometown in Russia, which doesn't get broadcast, just to help. Helps a lot of sort of deprived kids there, and you don't really get the chance to talk like that much, and we did, and I learned quite a lot about Zach. Yeah, in a day and age where everything, people do a lot of things just for sort of social media recognition, Zach's behind the scenes seemingly doing those things just because he wants to.
Have you had your team meeting for today? What's the drill for today?
It's mostly a couple of guys have a look at the early breaks. Obviously, there's a jersey up for grabs with the KOM jersey. I'm on look after Zach duty and then get stuck in the lead out of the end for Jens.
Have you ridden the Moor in a race before?
Unfortunately, yes.
It comes quite early, so a slightly different proposition here, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a race to the top anyway. All the Belgians will be wanting to crest first, obviously with the jersey up for grabs, that changes it. So we're sort of anticipating a big fight for the breakaway and then perhaps a big fight up the Moor as well. It could be quite unpredictable. It's the Tour. It's not like any other race. It makes every other race look like a club 10.
We're in Brussels, of course. You can't move for references to Eddie Merckx. Obviously before even my time, so before your time, but as a sort of cyclist growing up, what did Eddie Merckx mean to you, the name, and what does Eddie Merckx kind of mean to you now? Have you ever met him?
Yeah, I've been to his house when I was part of the Trek Livestrong team, now Axion, just run by Axel Merckx. So I know of Eddie, he was before my time, and like his achievements are huge, and for me with the hour record that he did as well, it was it's quite interesting. I think I said in an interview that perhaps he rode the hour record slightly wrong because he went for a bunch of records whilst he was doing it. It was quite something to say that in the press, I think. But for me, it's actually more Axel Merckx as being a director and possibly a director of the year that really sort of launched me into the pro world.
What was he like? And I mean, it must be very hard being the son of Eddie Merckx and working in cycling. Did you ever get that sense?
Not from Axel. And you don't get that sense from Rick Szabo either. I mean, Eric's won two times the amount of races as Peter Sagan. So, and yet Rick is forging his own path as a pro and Axel's done the same. And I think what Axel and all the staff associated with that development team have done over the years has been huge, because it is the most successful under-23 development team in the world, bar none, I think.
Your girlfriend is here working on the race in a different capacity. I mean, that must be nice to know that she's around, or will it be that you might catch a glimpse of her, but you're still going to be talking on the phone rather than actually meeting up too often?
I'll see her every day at some point, give her a hug, and that's the important thing. No, we're both here with a big job to do.
What's she doing?
She's doing a lot of the social media rider interviews for the German and English market. Actually, Chanel got selected a couple of hours before I did. So it was I was waiting, anticipating a phone call. Is it yes or no? And then Chanel was like, oh, actually, there's something I've got to tell you as well. I might be going, but like, we'll talk about it. And I was like, you have to go. It's a huge opportunity for your career. So she's already doing it. She's already killing it, I think.
Well, Alex Dowsett's roommate was in the break. Mads Wurt Schmidt, a big snorer, as we found out there. I mean, you know, that's the perils of sharing rooms on Grand Tours, isn't it? It's why we don't have a no room sharing policy here on the Cycling Podcast, don't we?
We certainly do, yes, absolutely. But that's meant that Francois is staying in not a very nice hotel here in Brussels, are you, Francois?
Well, I'm trying to stay as far... I mean, I don't care. I'm trying to stay as far away from you as I can.
Oh, well... Oh, yeah. We're staying with a friend of mine here.
The good thing about my not-so-nice hotel is it's got two mannequin pieces on its in its garden, you know?
Lovely.
So it's far more than you got in the rest of Brussels.
Yeah, I wasn't going to mention this, but Richard, you've been paying your own homage to the famous mannequin piece, the pissing boy in Brussels.
I've been doing some al fresco.
He's been caught short outdoors twice.
I have. Yeah. Well, it's a very green city. Lots of opportunities. anyway, let's wrap things up. We're you know. I mean, just because Daniel's not here doesn't mean we can go all, you know.
No, that's true. That's true.
Anyway, before we go, shall we say thanks to a few friends of the podcast who've signed up?
A big thank you to Lorraine Johnson, Matt Dickinson, Adam Daly, Martin Shea and Nick Downs.
Our thanks also go to Peter Martin, Matthew Bailey, Connor O'Neill, Nicholas Solman and John McLeod.
McLeod there, I think you'll find. And thanks too to Russell Irwin, Mark Deacon, Paul Follos, Gregor Domey, Teo Gagenhart, and James McKenzie. I don't know if there's another Teo Gagenhart, but if that's the Team Ineos rider. Well, your latest friend special, and if you sign up as a friend, you can get access to all the friend specials, is Lunch with Dave Brailsford, and a very good listen it is too.
Thank you, Rich. Yeah, it was a funny one, that, really. I asked him at the Giro whether he would be interested in sitting down for a lunch, a conversation over lunch. Anyone who's listened to previous episodes will know that it's not an interrogation. The only thing that gets grilled is the hake or the cod, and neither of which were grilled anyway. I think they were both pan-fried, but very nice they were.
Glad you cleared that up.
But there's a thing, I pay a lot of attention to comments on social media, Richard, as we all do, and in the past people have said, oh, the lunch gets in the way of the interview or whatever, and some people, that's a valid view, but I think that in a lunch scenario, or when people are kind of distracted by something else, it lends itself to a completely different style of conversation. It's not an interview in the sense of question and answer. I hoped
you're also sort of trapped, aren't you?
You can't just leave.
You can't call an end to the interview when you've still got dessert.
Exactly.
And let's face it, it's also an opportunity for Lionel to have lunch on the podcast.
When he came up with this idea,
you're seeing through the commissioning process.
That's exactly the point, though. That there's something else. When there's something else going on, there's a distraction. It actually takes the mind off the fact that it's an interview, and it becomes a conversation.
Yeah,
and there's an informality to it.
And I think you learn something about people in a different scenario, in a different setting. And I don't know what those things are that we learned. It's maybe not for me to say. It's for the listeners to say what kind of impression they got of Dave Brailsford. But certainly I would be fairly confident in saying a different impression to the one that you might get from his kind of more conventional media engagements. But just the fact that, you know, he didn't have a drink, he had water, you know, he ordered a very healthy lunch.
Well, you had about 5 pints.
No, I did not. I didn't. Because he ordered water, yep. I ordered water. Mm. Well, you know, we had fish, quite light. It was a warm day. One thing at the very end, I noticed that he was wearing trainers made by a company called Veja. And one of their things is that the trainers are made from recycled cotton and recycled plastic. And I made a comment about this to Dave, and he said, well, you know, when you work for Team Ineos, and he didn't finish the sentence, but it was kind of a glimpse of his kind of public persona, public perception, perhaps is a little bit detached from the real Dave Brailsford. And I'm not saying I got anywhere close to the real Dave Brailsford, but we heard a slightly different side to him.
And the whole conversation, well, we heard the whole conversation. There was no editing done of it. There was no shortening of it. One or two people asked whether there were any topics off limits. There was nothing at all. I mean,
there were no conditions. There was no PR person sitting in. There was nothing to say. I could or couldn't ask anything. So any failings of that nature are purely down to me.
Lionel, there's a gentleman who's just come and sat beside you. Who is this guy?
I don't know. We've been surrounded by a group of...
Semi-threatening.
Really quite well-oiled Belgian people.
Yeah.
Eddie Merckx. I heard Eddie Merckx.
Are you going to sing for us? Are you going to...
Because we're surrounded, by Eddie Merckx fans.
If you're going to beat us up, get on with it.
Are you
from Holland?
Oh. Sorry.
I'm Mike the winner today.
Yeah. You're his father?
No. It's a good friend of me.
No,
yeah, really?
that's not true.
Hey, Mike Turnus.
We are fan from Tom Dumoulin. But Tom Dumoulin is not in.
Yeah.
But this day we thought Dylan Groenewegen
will take the yellow jersey.
And a kilometer for the finish he fall.
Yeah, he crashed.
And then we talk Greg van Avermaat. We don't look good. And Mike Turnus. Yeah, Mike Teunissen, we're from Holland, Limburg.
Ah, you know he's
Mike
the first.
Mike Teunissen is from Limburg.
You know he's the first yellow jersey from Limburg. The first.
Mike is a good professional. 30 in the Paris-Roubaix.
Years ago.
Yeah, yeah. But Breuken was not from Limburg.
Breuken was the last one.
Yeah, but he's not from Limburg.
We're from Limburg.
Mike
Teunissen
is from Limburg. Yeah.
Limburg, in the top of Limburg.
We have both pools.
Oh,
and Mike Teunissen is in, yeah.
It's, I noticed you say Mike Turnus, not Mike Turnusson.
We had a great
Mike Turnus.
Oh, yeah,
Mike Turnus is a great...
Well, congratulations then.
Yeah, hello. I'm going to get you some drink. You, from us, yeah, we spare. What do you want? A Stella Artois song?
Yeah, Stella, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
and wonderful.
Yeah, same. Yeah,
very much. Lovely, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks to Mike Tennyson for winning this stage.
Here's to Mike Tennyson.
When a Dutch gift away, it's okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
It sounds like it's been a big day for them.
Yeah.
Here.
That's all for stage one from us. Thank you very much, Francois.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Richard. I'm frightened.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré. This episode was produced by John Mooney.
With so many options, why choose Arizona State University?
For me, the only online option was ASU because of the quality. Their faculty was really involved with their students and care about your personal journey. The dedication to my personal development from my professors, that's been extremely valuable to me.
Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university online. That's a degree better. Explore more than 350 plus undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.